It was decided, not by me, to live in Tennessee because the land was very inexpensive there. And there weren't very many rules. You could buy a bunch of land and live there, and you didn't have a lot of building codes, a lot of rules that had to be followed. And so we did. We moved back to Tennessee, and we found this land. It took us a while to find it. We found this land, and we bought it, and then we moved all our buses on. And so now we're living on this bunch of land, and now we got to farm it. We had learned to travel together. We had learned to live together, but now we had to work together. Yes, it was about 300 people. And so it began. The classic examples like, okay, well, if you want to take a shower, how would you do that? There's no shower house here. So that means you have to find a spring of water. You have to cap that spring. You have to pump that water. You have to get a tower and put it up and then pump the water into the tower. And then you have to build a bathhouse. You have to heat the water, and then you can take a shower. You have to do all of those things before you can even take a shower. And so it went with everything that we did. You want to have a place to fix your cars and trucks? You have to build that. You want to farm? We started out by hand. You want a house? You got to build it. Everything we had to learn to do for ourselves. People wanted to come live there, so we started growing. Pretty soon there's 400 people there. Pretty soon there's 500 people, and it grows. And it changes as it grows because the more people you have, the harder it is for everybody to know each other and understand each other very much. You can't really. It becomes sort of mathematically impossible, and you have to develop governance. And I can remember this process at first when there was like 300 of us or something, 400. I knew every single person there. I knew everybody by their first name, and I knew something meaningful about them. And then after it got to be like 500 people, I still knew everybody's name, but I didn't see some of them. I didn't really run into much. And then after about 600 or 700 people, there were people that I didn't even really know them. I just knew they worked there, and if I had to work with them or get to know, of course I would meet them or know them in some way. People were working very hard. We lived first in buses, and then we would put together these households, and people were very busy, and so there's like 600-700 people now. There were people that I didn't see at all through the course of the week.
Talking about governance, was this something you wanted to get away from? Because you thought it's... You know, the state is maybe not so useful or whatever. You just wanted to explore other ways you could live together?
It wasn't really very political because it was all organized around a charismatic leader. I think that it was almost more of a monastery model with an abbot or an ashram with the guru. Stephen, he would say, well, I'm a teacher, not a leader, and you have to learn to lead for yourselves. But it wasn't exactly false. It's just that he didn't trust some of the decisions that might get made. And so he actually had a great deal of control over things that got decided. Ultimately, it got to be one of the problems because it never did develop a really workable system of governance after a while. I mean, it's a long and complicated story, the farm. And it got to be too big. We would tell people that they could come and have their baby delivered there. And we would let kind of crazy people come live there. So it was very burdensome and it was expensive. Even though we lived really cheaply, it was a lot of people, and we didn't have much money, and so it was a profound state of material poverty. It was a time when there were a lot of other kind of gurus and teachers and communities happening. A lot of it was Christians and Jesus freak, and all of this kind of stuff was happening, and so there was a lot of people trying to get their message out in one way or another. And so we kept growing, kept getting bigger. And then starting after the mid-70s, we decided to set up satellite farms. And people started moving to these places. Our values included service, doing good in the world. And we had a lot of people by then who were medical technicians. And so we decided to move up to the Northeast and go to the poorest place in America, the South Bronx in New York that had the worst health care in America in terms of, there was one doctor for every 100,000 people. And so we decided we were going to go there and start a free ambulance service. And so I was part of that group that went up there. And we squatted in an empty building and took it over and started living in it. It was this part of New York City that had been largely abandoned and evacuated. And it was empty buildings and whole factories that were empty. And the heater in this building had been a coal furnace. We went through and we ripped out all the inner stuff that was related to coal. And so we turned it into a wood-burning furnace. We would get the wood by going into these abandoned factories. And I mean, I'm walking down the street in New York City with a wheelbarrow full of firewood that is a bunch of busted up pallets and packing wood from a factory or from a, some of them were like old clothing sweatshops. I mean, there were like these huge rooms where there was hundreds of sewing machines and the fabric was still on them. It was like they all went, okay, quitting time, and everybody left, and then they locked the doors, and nobody ever came back. It was as if all the people had just vanished. It was so weird, and nobody was around. We would go, and we could take anything we wanted. Nobody cared. It was completely surreal. My daughter was born in that building. I went down to get a birth certificate for my daughter after she was born, home delivery. And I went down to the county window, New York City birth certificate. I said, okay, here's my, fill out the form. And the lady at the other side of the window, she takes it. She goes, there's no doctor's signature. Where's the doctor's signature? I say, well, there wasn't a doctor there. It was a midwife delivery. It was a home birth. She goes, a home birth, no doctor? You have to have a doctor's signature. I said, but there was no doctor. No signature, no birth certificate. I said, but there was no, she hands it back to me. She says, honey, I don't make the rules. Get a signature. And so we had to go find a doctor who was willing to say he had been there, even when he wasn't, which we did. He was this nice guy, and he signed it. So my daughter has a New York City birth certificate because of that. You know, and so it went. They did form that ambulance service. I later moved with my family down to Washington, D.C., where we had another urban group house where we help American Indians in particular. Indians go to Washington, D.C. all the time to interact with the government in one way or another, or to protest or to whatever. And so we had a household where we helped them. And we were also very involved in the No Nukes movement at that time. They kept that ambulance service going for more than 5 years up there in the Bronx, saved many lives.
Going back to your story from the Bronx, I mean, taking out the wood from these sewing...
We call them sweatshops.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was not the counterculture, but, I mean, it was, you know, where unions got into, I mean, was the story of the left. I mean, these sweatshops were quite important, I think, for the politics of the left, for unions.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
sure.
There was this big fire, mm-hmm. And after that,
mm-hmm, yes.
People got on the streets and so on.
Right.
So, you know, it seems to me to some kind a bit symbolic that you saw these, you know, not empty, but left sweatshop. I mean, this was, you know, a past history at that time.
Yeah, I was aware of that.
But on the other hand, I think it's also part of your history as a counterculture.
I think so. I mean, I was certainly aware of that, and I was raised to be friendly to the rights of the worker. And unions, in my house, unions were a good thing. And I was aware of all that history. But what we were doing was so radical. We were living collectively. From the time I was 19 until I was 32, I didn't even have my own money. There are whole years where Social Security, they keep track of how much money you make. And my form in 1972, 3, 4, 5, all these years, it's zero. I had nothing. It was so radical.
And had you been aware that there were people living collectively in communes like that maybe 100 years before or 200 years?
A little bit, but not that much. In the New Testament, the book of Acts, about the apostles getting together, that they lived collectively. Everybody threw in and then but would be given to each according to their need. And so we thought of ourselves more in a religious vein, not strictly Christian, but again, sort of monastic in a certain sense, like a family monastery, if you could imagine such a thing. It was more religious than political.
And do you think this is true for most of the communes?
Some, yes, some, no. Some of them were very spiritual. Some of them were just some rich guy who had a bunch of money and had his friends live there. Some of them were artist collectives. I mean, there was all different reasons for doing it.
And for political reasons?
Sure. But by that time, I wasn't really political. I didn't want to be part of it particularly.
Why?
Because I believed in the idea of living out your beliefs. In other words, be the change that you want to see. I thought that society should remake itself very radically, very quickly. Not that I could make anybody do anything, and not that I was going to adopt violence at any level to bring something like that about. And I had no belief whatsoever that any government was going to go along with it. So the idea was to just do it and kind of live outside the government, live outside of those rules while not disrespecting those rules. Render unto Caesar.
And how do you think today about it? Saying I don't want too much to do with politics?
I vote. I'm a citizen. I have given money to political campaigns. I pay my taxes. I think that for real change, usually the political structure is the last thing to change, not the first. If you really want change, I would not start with politics. It's not going to work. Look at the acceptance of gay rights or gay marriage. The political process is following society. The culture changes. Ultimately, for real long-standing change, the political process has to follow, but it rarely leads. And so it's interesting, I mean, because we have climate change, we have war, we have all these horrible things are happening. And yet at the same time, I think there has been social progress. Once I heard Pete Seeger, the folk singer, talking, and he was a saintly man, really, who knew how to have a positive outlook. And he said one time, well, people are always telling me things are going wrong. Things are going really badly. Well, that might be, but I asked them, did you ever think that the Soviet Union was going to fall apart peacefully? Did you ever think the Berlin Wall was going to come down in your lifetime? Did you ever think that Germany was going to reunite? No. But it did, didn't it? Did you ever think that a black man was going to lead the government of South Africa? Well, no, but he did. Did you ever think that gay people in America would be allowed to get married? No, well, they are. I mean, these things do happen.
Yes.
Is it all going to happen fast enough that we don't destroy ourselves? We'll see.